Welcome to episode 52 of the Neural Network. Today, we have a special guest with us, Dr. Joel Schneider from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Dr. Schneider has some fascinating research that he does in his lab looking at auditory perception and cognition. So we talk a little bit about this, how this works, and what are some of the similarities to the visual system and how you focus in on a certain aspect of what you're perceiving in front of you. We also talk a bit about music and some of the effects that it can have on the brain. And then we talk about the much anticipated and popular topic of consciousness. So taking a critical look at one of the leading theories of consciousness in the field right now. And so it was a great discussion to have with Joel and get his take on this leading theory of consciousness. And then we talk about one of the papers that came out that sparked a bit of debate within the field in Nature Neuroscience, looking at a critical look at a theory called integrated information theory of consciousness. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. Okay, today we got with us Dr. Joel Schneider from University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Joel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Nick?
I'm great. Thanks for joining in on the show.
My pleasure, yeah.
Yeah, so the reason that I reached out to you is that, you know, I give sometimes these live talks in different audio rooms, and one of the topics that always comes up when it comes to neuroscience, as I'm sure you're aware, is consciousness. And especially being someone that studies the brainstem, consciousness to us is more of a confounding factor. And so we try to, you know, we try to do our best to remove consciousness because it muddies the waters in ours. Although, you know, it's starting to get into how does conscious modulation of these autonomic functions tend to go. But, you know, for us, it's something that we haven't really considered a lot about. And so whenever it comes to anything about consciousness, I tend to reach out and see, you know, for those that are actually interested in it, and those that are studying higher cortical function of perception, and I know you do a lot with audio, they're very fascinating from a neuroscience standpoint. And so perhaps for the listeners, if you could give a little bit of a background into, you know, what is it that you focus on? What do you study, and how did you get into those topics?
Yeah, well, I think the best way to talk about my research is that there's kind of two lines of it. And they don't usually interact, although I always think they should. Like, why not? So I started out interested in music, and I've done a lot of research on music. So when I was an undergraduate, I actually took a psycholinguistics class, but it was cool. But I realized, you know, there's a lot less done on music, and music is a lot more interesting to me than language. Sure. And so that would be a cool thing to go to graduate school for. And so that's more or less what I did. And I was always interested in the brain, although it took me a while to get an opportunity, you know, the right mentors and collaborators to do that. And so I've been doing research on music ever since. Even as an undergraduate, I, you know, did a, you know, class project where I collected data in my dorm room, people listening to music. So I've always been interested in that, and hope I'll keep doing research on that. And then the second part came along during my postdoc, which I knew about this area of auditory scene analysis, it's called. But it wasn't really my plan to get into it, but I had the opportunity to do that, and, you know, actually have a job, which was not trivial because I was I had a specific destination city that I was planning to go to. So I had to find something there, and that was the thing I found. But it's also been interesting, and it's actually what led me a little bit more into being able to, you know, make some contribution to the field of consciousness studies, as well as, you know, getting at the kind of basic questions about music and auditory scene analysis.
And what is auditory scene analysis for anyone that hasn't heard it before?
Yeah, so it's the title of a book by Al Bregman, a great Canadian cognitive psychologist. And he basically kind of, you know, borrowed the idea from the term visual scene analysis. And it's kind of the basic, you know, high level visual topic of like, how do we look at our environment and understand that we see objects, but we also see layout and foreground and background, and we can parse things, but we can also see things as an integrated whole and understand our, you know, our current place in the world, literally. And exactly how that works in the auditory system, you know, and so a lot of it is borrowed from concepts we get from vision because they had a head start and, you know, they've been trying to figure out how to get computers to do this forever as well. But there's some major differences between the auditory and the visual system as well.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of cool things that we can sort of bootstrap ourselves based on what we already know about the visual system, but also maybe pinpoint some unique things about how the auditory system helps us, you know, do, it's also called the cocktail party problem. You maybe heard of that.
No, I haven't heard of that one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, so the cocktail party problem, comes from some pretty old studies. And it's related to something called the cocktail party effect as well, but these are two slightly different things. So the cocktail party problem in general is what I study. And it's basically when you're at a cocktail party or any noisy situation when a lot of people are talking, how do you focus on the voice that you're trying to talk to, basically? How do you parse out, you know, the target of your attention, which is, you know, your friend's voice from all the background chatter? And it's something, you know, shared, you know, a problem shared with other animals like frogs and birds that, you know, could be, you know, all chattering at the same time, but, you know, especially like when they're doing mating calls, they want to, you know, focus in and evaluate one potential mate at a time. So it's something that's probably evolutionarily quite old. And then we do it in some unique situations like a cocktail party.
Oh, interesting. So how does that fit into, you know, those students that, or even people that are working that say, you know, yeah, I need to have music in order to focus on something. Wouldn't that kind of, I don't know, work backwards in a sense, or is it some sort of interaction?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Yeah, it's something, so one thing that's important to note is a lot of this research, you know, starting, you know, even before Al Bregman actually, but he really, you know, made this, you know, created this whole subfield himself in a way. But ever since then, a lot of the work has been using very simple sounds. So like sign tones and or noises or sometimes vowels. part of the reason is that, you know, when this was started in the 1970s and 80s, we didn't have all these nice computer tools for making sounds real quick. And so a big challenge has been really understanding the real world situations. But in parallel, there has been some research, especially with using, real speech that kind of gets at more real world situations. So there's something called the irrelevant sound effect, which is like when you get interference, like you're doing a working memory task. It might be a visual task, but, you know, if someone's chattering in the background, it can interfere with your ability to, you know, do a primary task. So, but yeah, anecdotally, yeah, and I can relate to this. I mean, when I was writing my, you know, qualifying papers, I listened to a lot of music while I was reading, you know, scientific papers and writing. I found that, you know, certain kinds of music, like instrumental music, I could do pretty well, but I didn't listen to a whole lot of, you know, music with lyrics because the speech could interfere with what you're reading. So I imagine I'm not an expert in quite that kind of interference, but
yeah,
I imagine there's some individual variation there, but
that's what I was going to ask next is that, you know, when I'm working on something like writing, for example, and you have music on in the background and it's instrumental, no big deal. Right. But if it has lyrics to it, it's a no-go for sure. But on the flip side, if I'm analyzing data, for example, you know, you're scrolling through files of an animal breathing or something like that. Mm-hmm. If it has lyrics, no problem, like whatsoever. Uh-huh. And that's where I was wondering, like, is there some sort of interaction between, like, you're trying to perceive the words coming from the music and it's interfering with the words that you're getting from the visual system? Or how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, and it's complicated because there's so many, I mean, a big problem when you try to do research with more naturalistic, you know, sounds, voices, whatever, is it's all over the place, right? Like, you know, you might pick certain sentences and other people might pick different ones and you could get different results because you're all using different materials. Same with music. So we definitely deal with a lot of complexity just from, you know, the experimental design and the materials we use, apart from, you know, all the complexity that the subjects bring to the table.
Yeah, we did. We did a study in undergrad. Just for like an undergraduate project research thing. And what we were looking at was actually music, and we were looking at how music. There was the interplay between music and the rating of perceived exertion during exercise. Ooh. And we were looking at whether you vary the tempo of the music with the subject's heart rate, or some sort of some sort of mathematical way to kind of match it without distorting the sound as much as you could. And we found that, you know, it was just a simple study with a couple subjects, but what we were finding was that as you, if the tempo of the music can sort of match the intensity mm-hmm. that the person is exercising at, then the, mm-hmm. the rating that of the perceived exertion or how hard they felt like they were going was very significantly reduced. So we were trying to find ways to make it easier to exercise at an intense level individuals that might not need to. You know, so it's kind of interesting when you talk about this interplay of how music is perceived in the brain or how it can modulate even different systems. It's kind of a fascinating
thing. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, and it touches on this idea of how rhythms from different sources kind of work together. I was always fascinated. I mean, when I was in grad school, I started doing a lot of research on rhythm. And it was kind of my main topic for quite a while. And I was always reading way too far abroad. Like, I just want to know everything about rhythm, including like how, you know, walking and breathing work and how they fit together. And I remember reading some interesting studies about, the interactions between different rhythms in an animal's own body, and thinking that that's really, really cool. And I think some people have touched on that a little bit when it comes to music, but there's a lot to do to look at it systematically. You know?
Yeah, that's fascinating. The whole world of music is interesting. I've played trumpet for a long time, and you know, it's not always the coolest instrument to play because you can't just break it out at a cocktail party like a guitar or something and start playing. It's a bit more of a jarring type of instrument. But yeah, just the idea of even trying to think musically versus thinking of something linguistically or something, it seems like a bit of a different process in the brain. Even how you perceive the emotional effect of it.
But, yeah.
So anyways, yeah. So I know, we wanted to talk a bit about sort of laying out the foundation for perception and how it feeds mm-hmm. into the greater idea of consciousness as a whole, which is always a hot button topic. And the reason, that I bring it up, I read your paper that you had in Nature Neuroscience that came out recently. It was a great read. I really appreciated you putting that out. And, I know I looked at the author list and I glanced at it first and I didn't realize that the first author was, IIT Concerned.
Right. And, right.
Yeah.
And so we had some trouble getting that to be consistently at the front. Like, I think there's some, maybe either the PDF or the online version that doesn't show up at first. And we had all kinds of, issues formatting exactly how we want it. So that might be part of the confusion.
Yeah. No, it was cool. That's why it was certainly unique. The first time I've seen that in a paper. So I'm, hands off for getting that through and I think it added a little bit to it. But anyways, for those that are unaware, there was a paper, you were the senior author on that paper, I believe in Nature Neuro, that came out looking at sort of a critical take on one of the, theories of consciousness at the moment called integrated information theory. And so I was hoping, perhaps you could give us a little bit sort of the spark notes of what that theory is, how it came to be, and you know, where does it fit in the realm of consciousness for people that may have never thought about how do we study consciousness?
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to clarify, I'm not the senior author.
Oh, okay.
And the way it ended up, well, I mean, I don't know how far back you want me to go, but there was, you know, there was a predecessor to this commentary that was posted on SciArchive, and that had you know, about 8 or 10 co-authors. And then they invited a wider set of people, including myself, to sign on to it without the opportunity to edit it.
Oh, I see.
And so that archive paper was never published in a journal, and it was very short. It generated a whole lot of stuff on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter, so I only know, you know, yeah, secondhand or thirdhand what all happened there.
Sure.
But then what did happen next is that this group of 100 plus people who signed on, and including the people who really wrote the original comment, we sort of realized, okay, this is having a big reaction, and you know, there's some subtlety that's getting missed, as always, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So let's write something a little bit longer with a few more references to maybe clarify some of the subtleties, and also, to be honest, to get it published in a respectable journal, in case that, you know, helps raise the issue even further. Not that it didn't get tons of attention, just putting it on SciArchive, because it did. But the original authors of that archive paper, they sort of, I mean, partly rhetorically, I think, I mean, I'm putting words in their mouth a little bit, but, you know, I think part of what happened is they wanted to take a step back and rhetorically say, hey, let some other people take a lead on this newer version of the paper, just to show that it's not just us, you know, causing trouble, but other people really believe this is an issue and will sign their name as corresponding authors. So myself and a few other people who are, you know, named after IIT Concerned, we're co-corresponding authors, just in alphabetical order. And then there's all those other people that that contributed. The difference, though, in this case is we put the draft on Google Doc, and everybody, all 100 plus people, had an opportunity to edit it. So it wasn't just the five of us or so corresponding authors, but we were more like coordinators or editors. Like, people would add stuff, and then we'd be like, yeah, that sounds cool, or I'm gonna tweak a little bit, you know, have some conversation. So there was a ton of input by a good number of people who are listed as those 100 authors. So the second thing that was in Nature Neuroscience was, you know, came about a little bit differently than the first one. And there was a lot of thought, you know, internal debate. We don't all agree on everything. We're not all experts on all the facets of the points we covered, like, you know, the computational aspects and so forth. So that's, I think that's, you know, kind of some important background to the whole thing. But yeah, I could answer your question unless you have a follow-up about the process.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. I mean, coordinating a paper with five people, let alone, you know, over 100 is just mind-blowing. But no, that's good. I think it's good for everyone listening too. I mean, just how those things absolutely work for some of those. Yeah. I mean, because I think, you know, in my realm of neuroscience, which is more on the neurophysiology mm-hmm. side, mm-hmm. You still have your debates and things like that, but it's less about debating these theoretical, I guess, large scale theories of how something comes to be. It's more about, you know, is it a sodium channel or is it a calcium channel kind of debates. And so it's a little bit a different type of of thing. So, So when it comes to, you know, the meat of what was being debated, could you, you know, provide a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we can get into also, there's a Nature paper published this Wednesday. I don't know if you've seen that, but that was actually an empirical test of IIT and another theory, purportedly. We can get into that later, maybe.
Sure.
But yeah, IIT, because, you know, obviously, you know, for a few years, there's been this effort. It's called an adversarial collaboration funded by the Templeton World Foundation, I think it's called. And they've been funding basically a group of scientists. I'm not involved in the collaboration. And they're trying to test IIT as well as some other theories. And there's some other groups funded by the same foundation as well. But IIT, you know, was kind of singled out as particularly problematic. Not that, you know, there's basically like over two dozen theories of consciousness, and they're all, as you say, they're not really in a way theories. They're like theoretical frameworks. They're sort of very multifaceted and sometimes hard to pin down. And even proponents of the theories will give, you know, different descriptions of them because there's a lot of different facets that you can focus on, you know. But the main idea of IIT, and all, you know, my personal experience with IIT goes back to, I think, before it had that particular name. So maybe when I was in grad school or so, I started reading, you know, about consciousness. I've always been interested in it. And so Giulio Tononi has sort of been the main proponent of this theory since the beginning. And at the time, I believe he was a postdoc working in San Diego at the Neurosciences Institute, which was this institute, you know, directed by Gerald Edelman, who was a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, I believe. But he, kind of like Francis Crick, you know, took his Nobel weight and, you know, maybe brought some legitimacy to the field of consciousness, which I really appreciated at the time and ever since. But so Tononi, Edelman, and another guy, Olaf Sporns, who I think is at Indiana now, they wrote a paper that really, you know, got me thinking, but also resonated with like my general assumptions already about how the brain works, especially sensory processing. And so the main idea to me, the part I focus on, is really simple and pretty, you know, to me, not objectionable at all, which is that, you know, in our sensory systems, we take an input through our eyes and our ears and our skin and so forth. And at least in, you know, a lot of those systems, the information's kind of broken down at various points, right? Like in the visual system, you know, you have a retinotopic representation in the eyes and in the visual cortex. So there's sort of like a two-dimensional layout of what you're looking at. And then furthermore, you know, what Hubel and Wiesel and others taught us is that furthermore, you know, past primary visual cortex or even in visual cortex, you know, neurons respond to a lot of different features or aspects, you know, wavelength, spatial properties, farther down the dorsal and the ventral cortical pathways, you know, you have shape information that's used both for recognizing objects, but also for reaching and grasping and moving your eyes appropriately to examine objects, right? So there are all these different aspects of visual information, and something similar probably happens in the auditory system. You know, we break things down in the ear by frequency, and then later on in terms of spatial properties and probably loudness somehow is coded, you know. Sure. But the point is that different pieces of information, like if you go to the very top of our experience, like when we're actually, you know, looking at a scene, like the picture that we have in front of us of the world, you know, there's color and shape, but it all seems kind of unified, right? Like, oh, it's sure. Not like the color is floating around and coming untethered to the shape. Like, it all seems to fit together pretty well. That's our phenomenological experience, right? And so my understanding, I could, you know, maybe the proponents would say I've got it all wrong, but, you know, my understanding all these years is that this information integration theory simply says that we break down information, different neural populations code for different aspects of our environment. I mean, our environment is also multisensory, right? Like when I'm talking to you and I see your lips moving and I also hear, I put all that together. And so the idea is that, you know, we have disparate populations of neurons that link up, they get integrated. And so the information gets integrated, and that's kind of the basis of our of our experience. And, you know, I think, you know, someone might object or observe that many people would agree that that's probably how the brain works, you know, not just for consciousness, but for other things, even some aspects of subconscious processing, right?
Yeah.
So to me, that's sort of the crux of the theory, but probably that's best considered at this point a weak version of the theory. Okay. So what's the strong version of the theory? Because the strong version of the theory is what we wrote the Nature Neuroscience paper and the earlier version about, which is that you could actually, in principle, calculate something called phi, which is sort of the degree or the amount of integrated information in the brain. And this is, you know, this is actually partly where, you know, my understanding breaks down, and I only partly blame myself, because I find that the more, you know, more recent papers, last 10 years or maybe more, of the IIT, you know, proponents, their writing's gotten kind of weird, frankly, like really sure. opaque and, you know, very, very metaphysical, honestly. And so they have these ideas about intrinsicality and blah, 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 all these axioms. They talk about their theory as being consciousness first, and let's set out these axioms about how consciousness is, meaning what it's like to have consciousness. And then sure. we're going to build our neural theory to explain those kind of introspective, I guess, aspects of consciousness. And that's where I'm just like, well, this is kind of opaque, which is not really what you want in a testable scientific theory. And then, but the other part of it, the part we really focus on in paper, is that if there is something called phi, well, there's no equation for it, and it sounds really difficult to, you know, to come up with a procedure for measuring it based on brain activity, because you have to, you know, not just consider like neurons firing action potentials, but somehow look at every spatiotemporal scale, and it just doesn't seem like, you know, maybe at best not a very useful theory, and at worst a truly pseudoscientific theory.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and that's where I always get lost in the consciousness things, is when it turns to sort of the metaphysical route. And maybe and I always thought, you know, perhaps it was just I've seated myself in a very objective or quantifiable realm within science of like how many action potentials are there, how many neurons are turning on, turning off, what's the ion flow or conductance. And when you start to take those and put them together, I guess integrate them into a neural network, and you start to look at, you know, how does an animal actually perceive the things that we might be measuring with our neural probes?
Right.
I start to lose it in the sense that I don't quite understand conceptually how to put measurements to some of those things, at least with the tools that, it doesn't mean that we can't, it just, you know, with the tools that we have available to us right now, sure. That's where I always get, you know, confused. Sometimes dives off into, you know, then we start to say, well, is this more conscious than this? And are these networks, you know? You know, the thing that I've always wondered, and maybe you would have some intake on it, is, you know, in the brainstem, we study in our lab, a lot of rhythmic neural networks.
Right.
And by all intents and purposes, these things work when you're clinically unconscious, if you will, or you sort of, you know, or I guess to give space to everyone in the consciousness field, maybe not unconscious, but you've reduced the consciousness value or perception to a level of where you can't react or perceive things that are happening.
Yeah.
But you still have like these neural networks. Yeah, like when you're asleep. Yeah. But you still have these neural networks that are firing. They're integrated. They have emergent properties. They are receiving input from other things, and they are dynamically complex, which, you know, to an extent sort of checks off all of the boxes for something that might be considered conscious to an extent. And, you know, when I look at it, then it's like, okay, so now we have sub networks that have varying levels of consciousness within a greater conscious being that of ourselves, of a human. But then if we scale that out again and we say, okay, well, now is, you know, the world, which is made up of many different neural networks of, you know, humans being their own neural network that interact, and you scale that out. Is there an infinite level of scalability of which you can keep going? I don't know.
You touched on a couple several really important points. And I don't know if I should just pick one. I'll pick up on one that's really important. And I don't want us to skip over it completely, which is, you know, what exactly theories of consciousness are trying to understand. And, you know, one of the things we write about in the Nature Neuroscience paper, I think, if I recall, is that, you know, one of the maybe features or one of the clues that a theory is pseudoscientific is that it tries to explain too many things, that it's a theory of everything.
Sure.
One of the things that causes confusion is that there are actually two different kinds of consciousness that totally legitimate theories can explain. And one is the idea of, you know, what happens in your brain when you're awake or asleep, or you're undergoing different types of anesthesia, which do different things to your brain, you know? And, a lot of focus actually, partly because people who study consciousness tend to be, you know, interested in perception. And we think conscious perception mostly happens when you're awake, except maybe when you're dreaming a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the scenario to think about instead of what, you know, a theory explaining, you know, whether you're awake or asleep, a lot of theories are actually trying to explain, like, if you're meeting a friend in a crowded environment, like at a cocktail party, or, you know, meeting them at a concert, there's a lot of other people distracting you. We know attention is needed to make us consciously perceiving our friend's face or something like that. And so what a lot of theories are actually trying to explain is, when you're already awake, what happens in your brain when you notice your friend in the crowd versus they may be in your view, but you haven't noticed them yet.
Oh, right.
And that's a very different problem. And in fact, you know, in the Nature Neuroscience paper, we talk about some really great research inspired by IIT, which is more trying to explain whether you're awake or asleep. One thing that some people suspect is that a weak version of IIT may be actually really useful for explaining, you know, those kind of states of awareness, like asleep, awake, under, you know, certain kind of anesthesia versus another. That's critical, right? Because you're right. Integrated information may be a hallmark of being awake, that you process information, whether you've noticed your friend, you know, there may be a representation of the face that is well integrated. But you just haven't consciously perceived it yet. But both of those things could happen when you're awake, and they might equally have high amounts of integrated information, which, you know, could suggest that IIT as a very general framework could be a good theory of, you know, awake versus asleep. Maybe not so much this other kind of consciousness of noticing something versus failing to notice something in your environment when you're already awake. But that's very speculative, because we don't know for sure whether a strong version, especially of IIT, can do that. But there is some cool research. Maybe I'll just explain a little bit what they did in these studies that we cite. So sure. they took people under different states: awake, sleep, you know, slow wave, or REM versus non-REM sleep. And basically, what they did is they used transcranial magnetic stimulation and kind of zapped the brain with a, you know, magnetic field, and at the same time recorded EEG. So they're basically looking at TMS evoked electrical responses in the brain, which is pretty cool, just as a technique that you can kind of pull that off, use both methods at the same time in people. But what they find is that when people are when people are unconscious, you know, asleep or under certain kinds of anesthesia, and you zap the brain, sometimes the information or sometimes the activity will spread from, you know, the site of stimulation to a lot of other electrodes all over the scalp. That suggests that, you know, there's integration. You know, there's integration of different neural networks. But what you tend to find when people are not conscious is that the responses are all looking the same, which suggests a lack of kind of differentiation or specialization. And so that, and they use that, those kind of responses to calculate something called PCI, which is Perturbational Complexity Index, I believe it stands for. And it's sort of a stand-in for PHI, but it's not, so we consider that like a weak test of IIT. And then when you're actually conscious, when you're fully awake, the information spreads, but you have all these different kinds of responses at different electrodes, suggesting a diversity of processing that kind of pulse to the brain. And so so they're using that as sort of an indication, like if they're not sure if someone, you know, maybe someone who has brain damage, they're not sure if they're conscious or not. You know, these can lead to medically important decisions, right? Under conditions of, you know, severe brain damage, when people can't communicate, but they might, you know, have locked-in syndrome, it's called. And so it might be useful as a marker for that kind of thing.
Oh, interesting. So, yeah. You know, because when you talk about that technique, I guess in my simplistic understanding or my simplistic brain, and perhaps my level of consciousness is lower, that, you know, I look at it from like a signal propagation standpoint of just the pure electrical properties. If you stimulate here, it projects to a given amount of things. But that what that doesn't do is it doesn't take into the account that there may be active pulling in of signals in order to elicit responses or something like that. You know, and so when you start to look at how the brain functions from that standpoint versus purely signal propagation, which I guess I should just explain for the listeners that in a simplistic neural sense, you can stimulate one part of a neuron or a neural network, and you can see how far that electricity makes it, almost like you're throwing a tennis ball and seeing how far it'll go. And that's based on the physical properties of the neurons themselves. And you can, you know, elicit certain responses or certain perceptions in individuals by forcing those neurons to fire. But, you know, what that doesn't take into account is there's this active process when you are in a state of consciousness where you're choosing to perceive certain things, or you're, I guess, maybe consciously or subconsciously. And that's, I guess, what the heart of the thing gets down to is how is the brain actually actively taking these signals and integrating them and spreading them across different parts of the of the cortex or of the higher processing centers. Yeah. And that's something that's always confused me, because it gets at that question of, okay, you know, I reach for something with my hand, let's say, you know, I had to physically choose to reach it. And we can map everything from the hand to the muscle to the neuron, you know, the motor efferent pathway to, you know, say this is exactly where the hand reaching thing is. But what we can't do is take that one step further and say, what is actually the thing that caused the initiation of the action? And, you know, and I guess the only quantifiable thing that we can put as of right now, at least in my opinion, is, you know, there has to be some sort of reflex, but we know that it's not reflex because somewhere free will has to come into it. And so, you know, from your perspective, you know, you look at a lot of things of perception and you sort of have, you know, the perception. I think what's cool about it, especially with the audio and the visual, is that what you choose to attend to, or your attentive space within the world, is a choice to an extent, I believe, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong on that. I guess there's some parts of if a firecracker is going off next to you, you don't really get to choose whether or not you hear it, but you can, you know, choose whether or not you attend to things. I look at, like, you know, my father watching TV when I was a kid, and it was like nothing around him would be even registering, you know, whereas my mom, if you snapped a finger, she'd jump or something. You know, but, you know, in the way that you look at the brain, where and how it integrates into these theories of consciousness and integration and things like that, how do you think about how the brain actually, or, you know, maybe it's extra outside the brain, I don't know. I there's a lot of theories on consciousness, but how do you look at it of, you know, let's say there's something happening that causes me to feel as though I chose to do a certain behavior or chose to attend to a sound.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess to get rid of the hard part first, I don't know where choice happens.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't know if it's you know, just like some aspects of consciousness, like why does red look the way it looks? I don't know that we'll ever get an answer to that, or if it's a tractable question. But I do think you raised something really important, and it gives me a great opportunity to address something earlier you touched on, which is, you know, if IIT is a problematic theory, you know, what does a more helpful theory look like? And I think there's a lot of good theories that are all, you know, probably all, you know, at least 90% wrong, but are useful and can help us move forward. And, you know, well, I think at this point, you know, what one way that others have broken down theories is in terms of, let's see, what do we all agree on? And one thing pretty much everybody agrees on is that when it comes to perceptual consciousness, at least, you know, whether you are noticing a face or a voice in the crowd or missing it, you know, that kind of consciousness, everybody agrees it relies on sensory processing. And not just rely, because obviously you need the eyes and the ears to get the information into the brain, but that, you know, especially cortical pathways for, you know, hearing and vision and touch, that when they're active, they can, not always, but they can lead to conscious experience. If someone taps you on the shoulder, sometimes you don't notice someone tapping you because you're distracted by, you know, the loud music at the concert, right? But if you do notice it, some part of your somatosensory cortex, maybe not the primary, but maybe a secondary part of it, will be active. And that neural activity is sort of a core part of what gives us experience. What, you know, what Crick and Co. called the neural correlative consciousness. You know, what are the real important neural activities that directly, when, you know, in principle you could stimulate them with, you know, an electrode. You know, when you do that, does it give rise to an actual experience? And so everybody pretty much agrees that sensory activity is probably happening around the time that you have a sensory experience. And then the broadest level question, as I see it, and other people have pointed this out, this way of thinking, is that do we also, in addition to sensory pathways, need frontal and parietal pathways as well? Or is what they're doing something a little bit different than consciousness? And so what I think, and I think that's a good way of framing it. And I'm not totally sure. I'm a little bit agnostic. I tend to think that the sensory only theories are more likely to be correct with, but there's has to be some qualifications. So I think maybe what's going on is another kind of useful way of thinking about it, which is, so there's the NCC, the neural correlative consciousness, which, like I said, everybody agrees it involves some sensory pathway activity. But there's some precursors to consciousness, and you pointed them out perfectly, which is attention is probably a key construct. And I use the term attention very broadly, but, you know, a lot of people will strictly, you know, define it as either two kinds of attention, either top down, like when you're actively trying to focus on a task, or you're actively searching for your friend's voice in a crowd. That's top down attention. You're sort of using frontal parietal networks to maybe pre-activate sensory pathways so that when you do see or hear your friend, those sensory pathways will respond in such a way that does lead to, you know, conscious recognition. Now the question is, if those attention networks are just a precursor to consciousness, maybe they're active before the sensory areas, but, you know, the information about the contents of your awareness, like the qualities of your friend's voice and their face, those might be restricted to the sensory areas, even though the frontal parietal areas played a big role in leading to the activation that led you to be conscious. So that's, I think that's a useful way to think about it. There's a bunch of theories, like the global workspace theory is one theory that's being tested or was tested in opposition to IIT in this Nature paper that was just published. And global workspace theory basically says that the frontal parietal cortex, it's more than just a precursor. It actually serves not just for attention to highlight the sensory pathways that lead to awareness of a sensory signal, but they actually act as something like a bulletin board, a global broadcasting system for the brain. And without that, information from your sensory pathways being broadcasted widely across the brain, you would never become aware of what's in your sensory pathway at the time. I think it's a little bit of a weird theory because, like, who's watching the bulletin board? You know, it's kind of a homunculus theory in my mind. But there are other theories that, you know, have different accounts for what frontal parietal areas might be doing that are necessary for you to be aware on top of your sensory pathways. So it's kind of the lay of the land as far as I see it. But like I said, I have some reasons to believe that the sensory pathway by themselves can lead to consciousness.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, I'm totally, like I said, I have no foot in any camp because I don't study consciousness. I'm here to just, yeah, you know, take in information. And as it's interesting, right, to right, me to see all points, you know, I guess I'm kind of in a similar camp in you that I lean towards the sensory stuff just because that's more what I conceptually understand from looking at neurons in the brain. I guess it makes a little bit more sense to me when I look mm-hmm. at it as a giant blob of firing things that has a bunch yeah. of connections in there. And one of the things about looking at sensory processing or not even processing or, you know, as you called attention or perception mm-hmm. or things like that. And one of the things that I've always been kind of curious about, and I've never figured out a good experiment to do it. I just haven't been able to figure out, you know, the landscape of how I would put together a project and get it funded to do it. But, when we're putting in probes, so we use these high density array silicone recording probes that can get, you know, a couple thousand neurons at the same time. And you can look at how these neurons interact with each other and put on different lasers and stuff like that to modulate behavior. But regardless, within the brainstem, the area that we're going in is sort of near the reticular activating system. And so we're going sort of in these ventorespiratory columns and near there is the cochlear nucleus. And, mm-hmm. And one of the ways that we can tell whether or not we're too lateral with the probe is if you clap in the room, even though the animal is totally anesthetized, is that, you know, the neurons will start lighting up. And you know, yeah. one of the fun things for the new students in there is if you do get in the cochlear nucleus, you can sort of clap a tune or something, and you can look at it, the actual neural processing yeah. of that yeah. music or of that sound in the brain, and or right. at least in the brain stem, I guess. The cochlear just encodes what's coming in. But assuming that, you know, a lot of these pathways are still relatively intact and they're still firing even when you're in a low state of consciousness or in a sleep type of state, mm-hmm. maybe we're not perceiving them or we're not attending to them. And yeah. I know that, like, sound processing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like sound processing in the brain still happens when you're asleep, but it's just changes the complexity of how it's encoded.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Is there, you know, a way of perhaps being able to force feed information into a unconscious network or an unperceiving network, but then later on be able to figure out a way to elicit a recall of that? Like, perhaps we haven't figured out a way to recall that information, but it's still in there.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, there's some things that I can think of that are kind of close to that. And it's a little quite outside my expertise, I guess. Yeah. Cause I'm not, you know, I touch on memory a little bit and I definitely don't know a whole lot about sleep or or even, you know, sound processing during sleep. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely true. There are definitely studies showing you can get, you know, different kinds of cortical responses to sound during sleep. The thing you kind of reminded me the most is this idea. I can't remember exactly how they do these studies, but there's a paradigm that's been used a lot recently where you use sound to reactivate memories that were formed while you were not asleep. But the sound, if delivered during sleep, can probably was paired with another, like a visual stimulus or something. So I know there's studies on that. And I think, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it, you know, like in terms of whether it'd be beneficial to be, you know, doing a lot of sound input while people are sleeping.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's sort of like, you know, I think, you know, I think a lot about the benefits of quiet and darkness when you're sleeping, or just for regulating your circadian rhythms, I guess. So I could imagine some bad effects of that.
Yeah.
yeah.
A Herculean type of study to be able to do something like that. But yeah. I guess the reason that I bring it up and sort of the bigger broad question of it, mm-hmm. and going back mm-hmm. into sort of critical ideas of looking at IIT or other sorts of consciousness type of theories is that from a standpoint of perception and a standpoint of attending or something like that, I think a lot of, you know, what we tend to perceive as the world around us, which is, you know, to our extent, our most attentive way of understanding the level of consciousness that we have at any given time, is sort of bound by what we can perceive, perhaps. You know, is the phi value, and I'm not familiar with the mathematics, and I'm assuming perhaps that you aren't familiar with the mathematics as well. I mean, I know that it's a very complicated algorithm. That much I do know. I don't have enough background in order to get at it, but do you know, like, is the phi value or this quantity of consciousness a fixed property of the hardware of whatever system it's looking at, or is it a dynamic value that is regulated? And if that's the case, mm-hmm. I guess either one, whichever one it is our ability to, I guess, perceive our certain level of consciousness, or our ability to go and grab a certain amount of conscious experience mm-hmm. from the network, are we just functioning at a lower value than what the total phi of the network is at all times, if that makes sense?
Well, I guess, you know, it's important to point out, answer a very small part of your question, that, you know, like a light switch might have a certain amount of phi, right? Because it has two states.
Sure. It's some panpsychism in, you know.
Yeah. So this is a problematic aspect of the theory. But yeah, in terms of biological systems, we know are conscious. I mean, yeah, I haven't done any phi calculations myself.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, presumably, I think according to the theory, you know, whatever sort of sub networks are actually giving you a conscious experience at the time would have a pretty high value of phi, and other sub networks, even though they're processing, you know, complex information that maybe is outside of your focus of attention, it would have a lower phi. I think that's basically what the theory would say. And of course people doubt that would be the case if you did calculate phi for an unconscious, you know, network that's nevertheless processing, like maybe you're just so aware of your visual environment right now, and the music is so in the background, you're barely aware of it. You know, a lot of us wouldn't be surprised if the background music still gave you a very high phi level, because it's not clear that sort of notion of integrated information really is what drives consciousness. I mean, you know, to go, I guess I didn't fully explain, you know, some of these ideas about the interaction between attention and consciousness, but I think it's really important. Because there's a real simple notion, and I guess it relates to, you know, this question about, you know, what's a useful theory of consciousness again? And I do think there can be simple theories of consciousness. I mean, the actual mechanism, you know, when you take into account all the different levels and, you know, the types of dendrites that might be involved in consciousness, because there are theories at the dendritic level too that, you know, outside of my expertise, but seem pretty interesting and potentially promising, and people seem to be taking them seriously. There's something called dendritic integration theory. But, you know, more at the level I usually think about, you know, there's just a behavioral notion that attention leads to consciousness. So whatever you're paying attention to, when you're paying attention to something, it increases the chances that you're going to become aware of it. So when you're looking for your friend, you know what they look like already, or maybe they told you what color shirt they're going to wear to the concert. You're somehow, you know, primed, right, to see that, and it increases the chances that you'll see it because of those interactions between attention networks and presumably sensory networks that have all that information about what things actually look like or what they sound like. And so, you know, I feel like that's a more promising way of thinking about it rather than, you know, I mean, this idea of phi, it's interesting. I've always been interested in it, but it just doesn't seem like that's all that plausible, because there's so much complexity in the brain, especially when we're awake. I mean, just look at all the brain rhythms, gamma rhythms, beta rhythms, and how they fluctuate over time and depending on what you're doing. But we know that attention is a powerful force, or even emotion, like when something's very salient to you because, you know, it's hit you in the arm before or shocked you, you know, in a fear conditioning, you know, that we have networks that highlight the salience of that. And they have powerful connections with different parts of our sensory pathways. And so those things are likely to become the focus of our awareness because they demand action, right? Especially in a like a fight or flight situation, like why would you not become conscious of something that has, you know, hurt you in the past?
Is there something like an attentive threshold, like the threshold for your ability to consciously attend to something in order for you to actually force a perception? Like if you prime, someone when they're right, listening to music, for example, mm-hmm. and then you say, okay, listen for the bass.
Yeah.
And you know, when they're normally listening to it, you know, like you were talking about, you have sort of this overall view of the music that's all culminated together in an integrated fashion, which is quite different from then if you're just listening to one portion of that, like you remove mm-hmm. all the other vocals and the, you know, everything, and you just focus on just the guitar. And you can blur out the rest of it. Is there a threshold for, and the reason that I ask is I'm wondering mm-hmm. is that with attention, especially in your realm with music, mm-hmm. for example, is lowering the threshold for your ability to attend things by proxy sort of enhancing the complexity of what you're perceiving, and by that nature, somewhat enhancing the conscious experience? I'm outside of my lexicon.
So no, I think you threw me for a loop a little bit, but I think it's just kind of the way you phrase things. But I do think, you know, one of the real longstanding theories of how attention works in, you know, especially in the visual domain, because that's where it's been studied a lot, you know, and these are, you know, based on, you know, animal studies looking at action potentials and so forth. One of the theories is that what attention does is just turn up the contrast gain. And so when you're paying attention, and the theory is pretty cool and specific. And it's not just an analogy. It's saying we actually have automatic systems that do gain control. Like, you know, when you go outside, all of a sudden everything's very bright or sometimes high contrast because there's stuff in the shadows. And then there's stuff that is illuminated by, you know, our beautiful star, the sun. Yeah. And so you have this new opportunity to have huge amounts of contrast that you weren't quite ready to process. And so we do that automatically apart from attention. Like every time we go into a different environment, and this happens with sound too, we adjust, you know, how much we're using our rods and cones, but even our cortical neurons undergo a tuning so that we can kind of home in on the range of contrasts that are relevant to our current situation. And so like in sound, it would be if you're just in your room and nothing much is going out, but you live in a city and you go outside, all of a sudden there's a lot of contrast between loud things and quiet things. And you have to retune to be sensitive to a change. And so this theory of attention basically says that attention is the frontal and parietal areas kind of tapping into those mechanisms of automatic gain control and adjusting them based on what's task relevant or what grabbed your attention because it sort of surprised you or was scary to you or something like that. So there's definitely some important relations between all those concepts, at least according to these pretty well established theories.
Yeah. See, I always get caught in the weeds of all of that stuff before I even consider tackling the broad concept of consciousness itself. But right. Anyways, you know, as we wrap up here, I think the idea of integrated information theory, it sounds like, you know, it's brought on upon a lot of interesting questions that have prompted further research, which is always, you know, something that is interesting. And definitely, and you know, when we talk about it solving something, it sounds like, at least at the forefront, it doesn't sound like perhaps it may have solved anything, at least as of this, or maybe added complexity to something that is already infinitely complex, perhaps. But you know, for from your perspective, where do we go from here? Like, what do you see as some of the most efficacious ways of going forward, knowing that we do have a lot of these very complex theories that are very hard to test?
Yeah. Well, so the Nature paper, and I encourage, you know, anybody listening to look at it, it's just published on Wednesday. You know, it purports to test global workspace theory and IIT. And, you know, the findings are complex. If you ask them, they say some of the findings support one theory, some support another. But myself included, a lot of people are critical of the way they did that because they generated hypotheses that didn't really get to the core of these particular theories. And furthermore, I think we should step back and say, was it even appropriate to test such specific theories? And I think the answer is no. Really, what we should get at is, you know, what are the key players in the brain even? Like, we don't even agree whether the frontal or the parietal or just the sensory areas are important. And so let's test that so that, you know, other scientists, the public can really understand what we're doing. Because right now, I think, unfortunately, like I think the data they collected is great. And I like, you know, the idea of adversarial collaborations. But I think the way they did that is going to cause more confusion. So I think, you know, doing experiments, whether it's a huge effort or just one lab doing it, being very intellectually honest about what theory you're testing and keeping it as simple as possible, I think is the way to go. I mean, just, you know, just like when you're testing very, very, you know, relatively simpler aspects of the nervous system. I think we have to do the same thing with consciousness as much as possible.
And I would add on there, try to figure out the best way to make it digestible in order to branch out to other sorts of fields that may have intuition into it that we may have never thought of. But
definitely.
That's always my kick because I get lost in the consciousness stuff. And I study the brain. Too. And so do you. But anyways, well, Joe, I don't want to take up too much of your time. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show, and I really appreciate you. Yeah. So I really appreciate you doing that. And so for the listeners out there, it'll be up on Apple and Spotify.